So I'm just going to briefly introduce each of the panelists, and then we'll get right to it and take questions together at the end. So our first panelist today is Sam Langer, who is from Melbourne but is visiting us from Berlin, where he's lived since 2011. His published works include Law You Can Eat, and I love this, 24 pages of floating rats with tiny hammers. Next up, we'll have Astrid Lorange, who is a writer, teacher, and editor from Sydney. She lectures at UNSW Art and Design and curates the talk series Conspiracy at Minerva Gallery in Potts Point. How Reading is Written, a Brief Index to Gertrude Stein, was published by Wesleyan in 2014, and her poetry books include Eating and Speaking, Minor Dogs, and Food Turns into Blood. And last, not least, Marty Hyatt, a poet from Melbourne, is with us today. He runs Bulky News Press and is also a translator. So please help me welcome the panelists.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. Thanks for having me at this conference, this wonderful conference. I'm a little bit nervous because I've been working on this paper for several months and it's still basically in progress, and I hope that I'll be able to give you a sense of the argument that I'm kind of trying to make about poetry. It's not so specifically about Australian poetry, I guess, but I'm going to talk about basically something that is probably familiar to everyone from contemporary politics and contemporary language, and I'm going to try and talk about a little bit about how poetry can relate to this or transform it or destroy it potentially. And what I'm talking about is like the title of my paper was something to do with the poetics of threats, and this is basically what Natalie and Ali were just talking about. I guess was one very good example of that was with the intervention in Australia. So basically, there's a way by which a particular language is used as a technique of extending government, essentially. So, like, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this in the US as well. Like, a threat is defined precisely in order to extend the power of government. And I'm not kind of saying that from some, I guess, Republican perspective at all. So, as I said, this argument is kind of in progress, and I have pretty much had to drop the theory part. So I'm just going to run through some quotations which give some parameters of my argument, and then I'm going to move into a reading of a John Forbes poem that you can see on the screen, and then a bit of a reading of part of a Gig Ryan poem. I think that's probably all I'm going to have time for. Right, so, yeah, the poetics of threat, I call it a poetics, or you can call it a poetics, because I think it's about, like, it's not necessarily about justifying actions of government in a kind of, in terms of a rational discourse, but more about producing a specific, like, producing a specific idea of time and producing a certain kind of relationship to affects, like, of fear, basically. And it's about, like, the production and maintenance of a certain kind of present, which is, like, the present that we live in capitalism, basically. Kind of trying to relate that to what Natalie and Ali were talking about, I guess it's also, in Australia, like, about Howard, I think, used this term, like, mainstreaming populations into the kind of you know, what's flexibly defined as like normative capitalist subjectivity, basically, which is obviously also like a colonial subjectivity. Okay, so this, here's some quotes. As every Australian agrees, to live here is to have won the lottery of life, because we are as free, fair, and prosperous as any country on earth. For any proposition is itself a set of symptoms expressing a way of being or a mode of existence of the speaker, that is to say, the state of forces that they maintain or try to maintain with themselves and others. Consider the role of conjunctions in this connection. In this sense, a proposition always reflects a mode of existence, a type. We should all be concerned about the future because we will have to spend the rest of our lives there. The essential function of the representation each society gives of itself is to influence the way in which each body is represented to itself, and through this to influence the structure of the psyche. If I had to sum up the immediate future of democratic politics in a single word, I should say insurance. The sick man, from timidity regarding death, eats what he is repelled by, whereas the healthy man enjoys his food, and in this way enjoys life better than if he feared death and greatly desired to avoid it. Well, of what object does one say that it has an opinion? Of Mr. NN, for example. And that is the correct answer. Who considers action from the standpoint of its utility or harmfulness? Not the one who acts. They don't consider action. It is rather the third party, the sufferer or spectator. They are the person who considers the action they don't perform, precisely because they don't perform it, as something to evaluate from the standpoint of the advantage which they draw or can draw from it. Okay, so here's my readings. After the bombs, we invent the future is a poem by John Forbes dedicated for R.M. Nixon, which is for some reason left out of the Poetry International version, which I'm showing on the screen, which appears in his 1970s collection, The Stunned Mullet. I'm going to propose three related readings of the poem, and particularly of the title, each of which unfolds a different perspective on the poetics of threat. So we can read the poem as for its historical moment, which is incarnated by Nixon and all that he represents and the fact that he represents. Nixon being the archetype of the ones at the top with their fingers on the button. The poem as dedicated addresses them, which is the we of the title. If they'll never read it, it still addresses the fact of them, initially by suggesting that the title is something for them to say or something they could say. It's in their language. You can imagine Nixon or Dr. Strangelove or Slim Pickens saying this phrase. And I guess I can read the poem. So, after the bombs, we invent the future. Let's paint the ideal supper on the back of our heads, where the poem is a type of hole, rope tricks and grit allow you to descend. We hope the earth has a centre, a fruity niche safe from the spiked shoes of the mob. When you cross to the pub, millions of hopeful athletes knock you over. Can you feel their lurid needs now that the speed of light's become obsolete, now the plankton is arising towards the oven? Where did you get that hat, Tarzan? Like miners caught in a war of time capsules, we quail before your green fedora, your dreams. Their glycerin slowly covers Mount Everest, and without peaks, how will the survivors invent a language? Oral hygiene be with us now and defend. So polish your neglect of tennis, for soon even casual knacks will yellow with nostalgia like the bandwagon of heaven's favourites or nicknaming your emotions. Otherwise, invest in dilemmas. The better you forget the days of jam, the more relics will surprise you. Still, after the age of the opposable thumb, there will be a lot to discover. Will dolphins enjoy bingo? Were the great comic operas written in perfect order? So, I don't have a lot to say about the content of the poem, which is obviously very complicated, and you could say a lot about it, but I'm going to talk more about the tone of the poem, I guess. So apart from the oblique references to total change with the speed of light, the plankton and so on, and references to extinction, does the poem like live up to this idea that it's like about Nixon and nuclear war, basically? Does it live up to this idea? or if it is supposed to be an apocalyptic or Armageddon poem, how do we, like, how are we supposed to make sense of the kind of poppy, absurdist tone of all of these images? And obviously, like, some of the ideas that are played with, yeah, they're difficult to make sense of, like, politically, I guess. And it pulls in a lot of different directions. I mean, that's obviously what the poem is supposed to be. So this is how I read this. Nobody knows what a large-scale nuclear exchange can do, as there's never been one before. So no one is obliged to assume any particular image of the consequences. If poetry is the destruction of clichés, which is like a big modernist if, which I still think you can relate to Forbes's work in general, then the destruction of the entire world is the perfect topic for poetry, an ideal supper which unleashes sense as universal contingency. In the light of after, all tones are equalized, the distinction between argument and digression vanishes, and so on. This doesn't mean that the poem is mocking the narrative of universal disaster from a rational perspective, nor greeting it from a nihilist one. The frame of the poem places its surface optimism in a specific contrast, showing that the optimization of disaster is already included in Power's Poetics of Threat. After the bombs, we invent the future doesn't exaggerate the logic of the Cold War. Rather, it's too true for the we of the title to ever pronounce it openly. If we are prepared to use nukes to defend our people against communism, then mass destruction on both sides is just a strategic possibility. You wouldn't run the arms race if you didn't think it was possible to survive and win it. Even if a bunch of them happened, which is, you know, on this reading is us, happened to be killed in the process. Well, I mean, yeah, us as a kind of general census type of population, predicted to be killed in a nuclear war. The technique of government, in this case, in the form of preparedness, will always aim to transform contingency into opportunity, even at the expense of life. So the title plays on the convention according to which Power doesn't deliberately say what it really thinks about its subjects. And so the idea that there's this displacement going on provides the occasion for the title to, like, reveal the true calculus. And now that's probably, that idea is already an oversimplification, because in a way, Power always says what it thinks about its subjects too. But anyway, Forbes's address to Nixon is conceptual in that it shows its actual readers their situation in relation to biopower. The casual knack of the poems in different contingencies are like a nostalgic little game in contrast to the idea of the technical control over contingency that, you know, nuclear powers specifically have. So as a dedicated art object, the poem chiefly figures Power's indifference to the subject's eager gestures. So I think the silliness of the poem is really meant to be a kind of, let's say, like, sewer sobriety, or like over hyper sobriety or something, meta sobriety. Like, because, yeah, there's this kind of optimistic tone in the poem, which is basically saying, make the best out of the worst kind of thing. But that's actually what Power already does with its control of contingency. So, in a way, the way the poem is thinking on this reading is kind of like the obverse rather than the opposite of what Power actually thinks about contingency. I'm kind of worried about that I'm going to run out of time before I say anything. Yeah, so Power can always offer up its bullshit declarations about the level of control that it has or the reasons why it's doing what it's doing, yet our kind of sense of things indicates that these reassurances will always be ironic from the perspective of those who end up as the victims. So, yeah, the optimism of the poem is ironic. Big whoop. Okay, so, but what is that? It's obviously an ironic poem, yes. But what am I trying to say with that? I'm trying to say that, like, this conceptual relativity that the poem kind of unleashes is kind of the mirror of the biopolitics in the shadow of which it is able to move. The poem is a type of hole. It's like a bunker. So, as a fake discourse, the poem is mirroring power's fake discourse. Okay. Skipping on a bit. Yeah, so the poem is, like, let's say the poem is true by being untrue and untrue by being true. And it's sort of attempting to see itself from all angles. And basically, I think this is like one proposition of like a subjectivity, which is by means of critique, basically, is trying to deny its own position of alarm. Okay, and so then I connect this to... I'm just going to skip a little bit. Yeah, I think that the kind of negative comfort that this irony is offering us kind of resembles a post-Cold War discourse of power, which is what I'm talking about in terms of a contemporary poetics of threat, which aims to shape subjectivity and generate a specific form of agency by permeating the present with threat. So, and this is like maybe the very perverse part of my paper, is that I think you can map the tone in this Forbes poem and probably some other Forbes poems onto this John Howard era terrorism threat slogan, be alert but not alarmed. This was one of the slogans, and I'm sure there's a similar one in the States, like, which, and the slogan is meant to, it's not actually a direct instruction. It's meant to encourage you to provide information to the security services and implicitly consent to the general kind of anti-terror, what's the word in English? The general anti-terror kind of rabble-rousing by the government, let's say. Rabble-rousing is not the right word either. Sorry. Sorry? Yeah, the Hetzer. That's what I'm trying to... Yeah. So, the slogan is meant to encourage people to consent to the general anti-terror atmosphere, let's say, precisely by suggesting that they could be afraid of the consequences of not providing information, even while reassuring them that they don't need to be afraid. Does that make sense? The slogan operates by denying the fear that is expressive of a certain determinate relationship of force. Can you yell out? I'm running out of time as well.
Yeah, I think you have 5 more minutes.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, and I think this shape also describes the way that irony as warning / warning as irony works in the Forbes poem. I think that, so I'm kind of trying to say that this mirrors the kind of structure of the language of power, basically. And so its critique of that structure is not really able to separate itself from its, yeah, like the world to which it's subject, basically. And then, yeah, so then you can read the title of the poem in a second way, which is like the present that we inhabit now, is one where we invent the future as the poetics that creates the neutralized present after the bombs, as you might write poems after a poet. So, like, the present is kind of permeated by the future as a way of neutralizing any political possibility, basically. Yeah, so I'm going to just go really fast now. But then the third reading, which is like a kind of immanentist reading or something like this, is that... and then this brings me to my reading of Gig Ryan's poem, is that basically... Yeah, so Forbes is doing this entertaining speculation on the contingency of the future in relation to disaster. But that's a very specific conception of disaster that he's working with, which is like nuclear war destroying everybody in the world, right? But I guess the thing about disaster that one can come to realize is that the world has already been destroyed many times, and many different worlds have already been destroyed, and that we, as we've been discussing, like, we live in the kind of, we're still alive, or all kinds of different things are going on in the wake or in the ruins of various destroyed worlds that kind of coexist. And that's a very inadequate formulation, but that's what I'm trying to get at. So after the bombs, I guess there's another we which can invent the future if the bombs have already been dropped. So, like, you know, Tony Abbott says we can expect to see more of this kind of thing in the future when a kind of random, you know, terroristic event happens, and you get this sense, like, when the latest thing happens, that it's really not, it's not, it's already happened and it hasn't happened, I guess. If that makes sense. Like, if we're anticipating this kind of randomness already, but also it's impossible for anything to happen because of the kind of continuous extension of, yeah, power and control, basically. So I'll just go really fast and talk about this poem January from Gig Ryan's first book, The Division of Anger, and I'm really just going to talk about one detail of the poem. So there's a kind of a... there's a yeah. Yeah, so basically there's a... Sorry? Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to... again, I'm not going to attempt a reading of the entire poem. I'm just going to talk about a couple of details. And basically there's a scene and there's a cockroach which appears in the scene in a kind of ambiguous way. And possibly the narrator is, in a way, identified with the cockroach, but we don't need to go too much into that. So, like, there's... the cockroach basically has two predicates attached to it. It survived Hiroshima, which is kind of strange because, you know, the poem is being written in Australia in the late 70s, early 80s, so it's like a long time after that event. But the cockroach is basically predicated as a survivor of the bomb, which I guess, in a certain way, everything is. After that, after those events have happened, or after that possibility has been unleashed into the world. So, yeah, let's say the cockroach isn't building any bunkers, and the cockroach isn't engaging in kind of any sort of rationalized or economic preparedness, I guess. And so the cockroach's smallness is its other... it's the only other predicate is given, is that it's smaller than a policeman's heart. And so the cockroach is measured in a way that deranges scale and escapes measurement. How can a policeman's heart be the absolute, yet surpassed, benchmark of smallness? Does this then mean that the cockroach is more like a policeman than a policeman is? If the policeman's heart is able to play that role in the poem, it's because it has to shrink, or has had to shrink, in order to be what it is. It's as though there were a tendency for the policeman's heart to become ever smaller, perhaps so as to trap cockroaches and other out-of-place matter that tends to camouflage itself. The policeman's heart is rapidly shrinking to the size of a point, but the cockroach somehow manages to still, at the moment, or in the event or something, be smaller than it. The cockroach survives by occupying a relative non-position in becoming, and that's the kind of immanentist cliche that I'm trying to put into motion here. Like, so if the policeman's heart is infinitely shrinking, we see by the end of the poem that it's turned into a blip, because God comes up on the radar at the end of the poem, which is another very strange, great image, God coming up on the radar. Because if God comes up on the radar, then God has, like, been reduced to the status of a blip or a point, right? So we've got this kind of infinitely shrinking policeman's heart, which has turned into the point, something that puts a stop to becoming and tries to stamp it with a final and unavoidable meaning. When God comes up, God organizes the entire display around God. God was always going to come up. But God's conclusive fulfillment of narrative is here viewed in a deflationary way, as though through an offhand petty instrument that he has conjured up. When cataclysm arrives as more of the same, then yes, God is a table. Their God knows just when the world is going to end, tells us that we can expect to see it at any moment, and expects eternal service for the favour of preventing what it has invented. So I think I'll just stop there. There's a lot that I was not able to talk about, but there it is. Thanks a lot.